everybody. Welcome to episode 213 of the Mobilecast. We're still live here at VMworld, and I am lucky enough to be joined by, if you were listening to episode 212, Amy Lewis said I had to hashtag her as unabashed badass, Jody Tyrus, who is the technical architect of data security at E&J Gallo Winery. Jody, please introduce yourself, because I'm lucky to have you.
Thank you very much. Hi, everybody. Jody Tyrus. As Brian said, I'm out from Gallo Winery in Modesto, California. And usually when most people think of wineries, they have an image in their head of a very small...
Fields of grapes.
Fields of grapes and... people smashing grapes with their feet. But Gallo is one of the largest wineries in the world. We have quite an expansive brand list, and we have a lot of companies that are under our umbrella that help us out with our supply chain. So not only are we a winery, we have a glass plant. We have a logistics company that's affiliated with us, and we have a huge sales force that's out there moving our product.
And the good news is it's consumable and it's fun to drink. But anyway, let's talk about you. Yeah, we're going to get into, obviously, we're the Mobilecast, but you're in data security. And, you and I have talked before, and we followed each other on Twitter and have plenty of conversations there. But how did you get from where you started? You've been in this business a long time, and we kind of had a pre-talk here. But give us a little bit of your history.
So, yeah, I think people are surprised sometimes when I say I've been in IT or IS or tech industry for about 20 years now. So I started out coming in from a retail background, and I was looking for a 9-to-5 job. Which, if you look at my path now, I would love to have a 9-to-5 job, but...
Nobody tells you the tech really isn't 9-to-5 if you're really into it.
I was looking for a 9-to-5 Monday through Friday job with holidays off, and back in the early 90s out in the Bay Area, what I could get with my skill set, which was primarily, lightning fast on the 10 key from working cash registers and some customer service skills, I went into a data entry for a small semiconductor company out in Fremont, California. And luckily, because I was so quick entering in orders, I had a lot of free time. So they said, well, just follow around the contractor that works on our network and help them out. And this is the days of ThinNet and Novell 3.1.2 and running Windows 3 off of a network share. So it was a lot of fun getting in that early, and I just had an aptitude for it. Learned really quick and was lucky enough to be at a company that invested in me. So I would end up with free time and I'd say, I'd like to go take a Access database class, or I'd like to go learn about networking, or how about I get my certification on Novell? And they saw the return on the investment, and I continued to do that for a couple of years. Moved out to Cincinnati and worked out there for a while, and then came back as a freshly minted MCSE back in the heydays of the first internet bubble before that burst. So it was exciting times. I worked for an internet startup company called Visto, which nowadays most people know them in their current
incarnation.
A big $5 word as good technology. So I've done the startup, I've done mid-sized companies, and then an opportunity came to work at Gallo, which is about 70 miles east of the Bay Area. They have a really well-known IT department. My original job out there was working on the server side. So my background in server OSs like Novell and SCO and Windows, they needed someone that could come in and help build out their server infrastructure and the applications that supported our line of business. One of those was our grape receiving software, and they found out that I had SCO background and I knew thin terminals. And so the first 6 summers I spent out supporting our vineyards.
Well, that's kind of cool.
Which kind of, when people ask me, how did you get into wine, is when you're sitting around a test stand at 2 o'clock in the morning with a winemaker, you talk about wine. So it was a great opportunity. And about 8-9 years ago, they had and opening the security department, and I was asked to kind of come into it because I did have a pretty solid background with the other things I was doing with security, and I said, yeah, sure. And it's been security since then.
You've been there since then, and you know, to be fair, and Jody's humble, but Jody's well known in the security circles, and you know, she knows her stuff, and you know, that's part of it. And I think one of the reasons that I wanted you on the MobileCast is in one of our conversations, you mentioned that you were one of the pioneers at Gallo in how you set up mobile. So how long has Gallo been mobile?
We've been mobile for a long time, and when I say the pioneers is when we looked at, you know, kind of the current tool sets that we use, smartphones. But if you look back over at Gallo for the last 20 years and even before then, you know, we were using laptops. We were using synchronization software. We have, you know, hundreds of salespeople that are out in the field that are not only selling wine to stores and to restaurants, but, you know, checking up on our product in those areas and making sure that our product gets on the shelf and is being sold. So with that, we've always had to have a pretty solid understanding of what we needed to do for mobility. The transition came, though, when instead of being, you know, just kind of a single-threaded tool, I just need to get mail and I need to get my reports, we started having people come to us and say, hey, you know, I want to do more. I want to do – I've seen the iPhone. I've seen earlier tablets. I have one. I want to use this. And we realized that we couldn't treat these the same way we treated – laptops that were running a Windows OS that were connecting through VPN, you know, that really required some out-of-the-box thinking. So myself, along with our desktop services manager and our network services manager at that time, we got together and, you know, kind of an early team and said, you know, what should we do? What kind of the philosophies should we try to lay down? And then how do we get the business to align with us?
So it sounds like you actually were approached by users mm-hmm. rather than the business, you know, because these days it's the business that may be pushing to come online. But you actually had users who said, sounds like I can do my job easier or better, get more done, be more productive. And help me, allow me.
Yes, and that's a change because, like a lot of companies, you know, we were going to users with saying, you know, here's an upgrade, here's some technology we think you guys would like to use, and it was kind of like us pushing that at them. With the smartphones, with tablets, we had our business customers come to us and say, we think these are cool. We think we can do more with these. You know, this is a device I can take into a meeting with me and not be very obtrusive. This is intuitive. What are we going to do? What is Gallo going to do with this? So that was a change for our technology team at Gallo because we were used to just sitting kind of making edicts and we're going to do this and we're going to do that. But because of this, you know, this shift, we realized we couldn't kind of drive our customers down the same path that we wanted to go. We really had to listen a lot more, understand how they were working, how they were going to use the devices, and really make sure that, you know, when we were talking about adoption, we didn't want this to be something that, you know, was, you know, yeah, we spent a lot of money and it's on a desk somewhere and people aren't using it.
So it sounds like the approach might be, you gave a few devices out and looked at how they were being used, or yeah, how did you approach it in the beginning?
We had people who had their own, because of the security that we had in place, they weren't able to do much with it, but they were asking about it. So we started with a small pilot within IT department, like most companies do. You start with a small POC, and then you start involving your business customers. You let them kick the tires. You let them, you know, and then they'll come back to you with some more requirements and say, okay, this worked great. I can get my email, but I would also like to use it similar how I use my laptop. I want to get into this system and this system. And it was challenging, though, because these are not Windows laptops. You know, so
in some ways that's easier and that's better. In some ways that can be a headache.
Yeah, so we had to make some decisions earlier on about how we were going to manage these devices, how we were going to track them, what we were going to allow, what we're not going to allow. And we wanted to make sure that we weren't making those decisions in a vacuum. Yeah, because as a security person, a lot of times it's really easy to say no. And if you become the department of no, then people stop coming to you. But they're not going to stop doing what they want to do.
Yeah, one of my favorite expressions is IT can no longer be the department of no, N-O. They have to become the department of no, K-N-O-W.
Yeah.
And so, but you mentioned security. How does your focus on security really come into play with what you were doing with mobile and the approach you took and how you moved on with it?
Yeah, so when we looked at these devices, when they first came on our network, it was, you know, there was a lot of, I don't want to say fear, but there was concern that, you know, these were hostile devices because we couldn't control them the same way that we were doing our Windows devices. So when we looked at tools that were available, the mobile management platforms, application delivery, some of those things, you know, we kind of scoped out what are we most concerned about. What's our biggest threat with these devices? Are we going to allow certain applications on there and treat them the same way we would if you were going to go home and whatever applications we have that are available through a browser? So we did a lot of mobile stuff and remote stuff ahead of time. You know, like many companies, we have an employee portal. So the thought was, whatever you can do on an employee portal, you should be able to do on a device that's mobile. And there's really no difference in there. So that's kind of the stance that we took is, if I can go home on my own machine and do something, I should be able to do it on this device. So we already were delivering email and we were delivering self-service to iPhones and tablets. Now it became, how do we deliver other services that we have?
And what's interesting about that is a vastly different approach from most early adopters. And to be fair, you guys were a fairly early adopter.
We were, and we went to a lot of industry focus groups. We did a lot of research. The words BYOD were thrown around a lot, and people were kind of jumping on the bandwagon with that. What we decided to do is, to step back and take a look at, number one, what we were trying to deliver and what our customers were asking for, and that to make sure that we were aligned across the board, not only from IT in the end user, but all through, the normal departments that have a say in these things. We had established a few years before a security council at Gallo that had was comprised of individuals from lots of different line departments. So you have legal and HR and marketing and sales. And when we decide that there's going to be a shift in a security philosophy, or there's a need to communicate down to the business about something, that we were going to engage at that level so we were all on the same page. So when we came out with this kind of, what are we going to do about mobility, we went to our leadership and said, what do you think we should do?
It's fun listening to you because I do a lot of, in the past, I've done a lot of security stuff. And when I talk about it, and we'll talk a little bit about policies in a bit, but I've always said, you need everybody involved. You can't make these decisions in a vacuum. It sounds like it's a tribute to what you guys did, that you just instinctively found the way to do this and had the smarts to make sure you had the people, right people involved beforehand.
Yeah, a lot of times you have some competing interests, but it was great to hear from our sales and marketing VPs about how they wanted to use this tool and about how excited their people were and kind of what their requirements are. And at the same time, understand what concerns that the legal department had, HR, all across the board, so that you could kind of discuss those and come to decisions. And sometimes there were compromises. And from a security standpoint, you need those people to back you up. You don't want to push out a policy and then have to pull it back 5 months later because it failed. and nobody agreed with it. So by doing that in the beginning, what you ended up with was something that everybody was on board with, and they weren't surprised. And you know, the VP of marketing and sales and HR, they didn't have, when people came to them to ask about that, they're like, yeah, we talked about this, we all agreed this. So
and they can socialize it themselves.
Yeah. You socialize it from up from the bottom through IT, and then across the board down through the leadership and the security council. And it really empowered people, and they felt like they had a stake in the game. They had they were invited to the table. They were able to voice their concerns or their wants or their needs, and it was listened to, and you came up with something that everybody could agree on.
So you had, I like to call that, you had concrete use cases. At the same time, you had the people involved who want to put some control around it, but they had to listen to what needed to be able to be done, because business still needs to happen.
Yes, yes. At the end of the day, I mean, this is something that we talk about a lot at the winery. We are a winery. Our job is to make wine, ship wine, and sell wine. We're not in the business of, we're not just we have a nice, big, very well-known IT department, but we're a winery.
And to be fair, she didn't bribe me with any wine beforehand.
No. Yeah.
It's interesting. You didn't say, how big is Gala?
So we're still a private company, so a lot of our information is not published out. But we're between.
Well, I won't ask you about money, but yeah. I'm curious, number of people wise, what's
so
means.
It. We are still based in agricultural, so during the summer, during harvest season, our numbers spike a little bit because we add a lot of people. We add interns.
We add grapes.
We have people that are out there for harvest activities and pulling the grapes in. But we're around 4,000 to 5,000 people worldwide. Most of those are out in the Modesto area or at our production sites up and down California. So not only do we have corporate headquarters in Modesto, we have production wineries in Fresno and Livingston. This week we have some of the people, the Spositivities people, were visiting up at our William Hill facility. I think that's today. And they also went to our Fry Ranch, I believe that's that, out in Sonoma.
Oh, very cool.
So
we're at VMworld, and there were spouse activities, your significant other, that you could sign up for. And one of the things, the activities, was to actually go to the winery.
Yeah.
So the benefits of bringing your significant other to VMworld, they get to enjoy some things while you're out learning stuff.
So when you look at what we're doing for mobility, there's not a single use case. We have people out in the field, when I say field, like in the salespeople, that need to get reports, that need to get their email. They may need to submit forms. They're very, they're a lot of transition across from where they are at any given day. You have people at the corporate offices that are mainly day extenders. So during the workday, they're on the campus in Modesto. They might be at a cubicle. They might take their laptop. They might be working off of their smartphone or their tablet. And then you have another use case where you might have a tasting room, and they're using it as a mobile register or, for a visitor to look at something on there. So there's a lot of little individual use cases, and there's not one simple answer to how to secure these. There's core security concepts that we believe in, but then we have the flexibility to say, if it's this type of device used in this manner, these are the rules and these are the policies around it. If it's this type of device, here are the rules and policies around it. And we found that, you stick to your core values, but you have enough flexibility to account for how different people are using them in different manners, that you end up with, I want to say 100% happiness out there, but closer to 90% than you are at 50%.
So if you're allowed to share, how much of you is BYOD versus corporate-owned, personally enabled?
So when we, like I said, there was a lot of interest in BYOD early on. We were primarily a corporate-owned devices. When you look at some of the reasons why we, decided not to go down BYOD, there may have been some cost savings, but there was a lot of things that we would have had to account for, especially with some of the laws in California.
Being in California, it's interesting as far as you have to pay tax on it, you have to reimburse. There's a whole bunch of rules around that that we've seen passed recently.
Yeah. So when we looked at that, just kind of trying to, how do you account for that? How do you manage that? You would have ended up adding more people just to do some of those things. So when we what we looked at doing is saying, our people are pretty happy with the devices that we've chosen. We'll give them a little bit more flexibility and maybe not, you know, are you this make or model or not this, you know, this make, but what size you want. And then personally enabled it.
Yep.
So you have some freedom on that device, but it's a corporate owned device.
It's one of the beauties of the term, and actually a good friend of mine, Philippe Winthrop, coined the term COPE, was the fact that, and what many people discovered, when you allow people to personally enable their device, they take care of it much better than they do if it's just a corporate device. They don't get broken. They don't get returned nearly as much.
And well, we still have some breakage.
It doesn't mean that somebody doesn't drop it, but
they have some skin in the game now.
Yes.
One of the other things, too, is these are, I go back to the thing, these are not a traditional laptop. And I'm holding up my phone right now. I carry this all the time. It's either in my hand, it's, you know, by my bed, it's in my purse,
So you haven't grown out of when you used to be in operations and you had a phone by your bed. And yes, I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
I'm there with you as well.
Yeah, this is much better than the old SkyTel pagers. And I've seen people at work operate the same way, even though they're not kind of in that technology role. It's with them all the time. They're managing not only their work life, they're managing some of their personal life. And one of the policies I'm most proud of that we were able to get alignment on at the Security Council was that we were going to respect the fact that we were asking people to use this tool and that they wanted to use it for personal reasons and protect that privacy. So it was kind of baked into our philosophy is, you know, there are certain things that we could do, but we're not going to do. So a lot of companies, you know, when they sit there and look at how they're going to adopt a mobile device management platform.
Legal and security love to say, can we do this?
We can do a lot of things. And do we want to?
And that's a question that doesn't get asked often enough.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. We were an international company, you know, and you do some international work, obviously, as well. But, you know, there are places overseas like Germany and other places where privacy is paramount, even if it's a company device. You couldn't do GPS tracking and everything. Whereas in the States, you could. And, you know, we made decisions not to do it unless we actually had a good reason. And then, you know, you had to inform the user exactly what it meant, when it meant, what you could do. And so that kind of leads us into policies. And I think you've actually answered part of the question was, how do you create policies? I'm going to guess that you go to that same team that you talked about for security.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's some policies that are, you know, they're very transparent. So a lot of that people that are actually using the device would never even know, are we going to back them up? Are we going to do this? But there's other policies that are going to, you know, kind of they're right in the face of the user. So when we first started out the gate, it was we're going to have a PIN. And at that time, a lot of people weren't used to having, you know, a PIN on their personal device, and it was kind of a pain, and they were very vocal about it. So, you know, it's like, well, this is why. And when you sit there and you kind of paint the picture of why it's important to have certain policies, and you give them the reasoning and you explain it to them so that they...
In English,
but as an adult, and it's not, someone sitting in a white tower somewhere and just passing down laws. You talk to them why, and it became very apparent that, okay, well, that makes sense. And then we went to a lot of talk around, well, we want, in addition to email, we want these types of services delivered to our devices. So maybe it was the ability to VPN into a file share. Maybe it was an application that we either bought or built that gave sales information or marketing information. But we don't want to log in 16 different times. So how do we accomplish that? And so we made some architecture decisions about how we were going to allow that. And we came, when we went back to that, you know, you compromise. Now we have a stronger pin, but everybody is pretty happy because of everything else that we've opened up for them. It's kind of, we've tied into a single sign-on system.
We put more security around it, but we've also enabled you with it.
Yeah.
And so buy in. And it's also interesting, you know, I've seen in the past where I've talked to people and said one of the ways to sell PIN is it's also protecting their personal data.
You know, that is so true. When we do a lot of security awareness, the biggest impact I've gotten is to talk to people and use the analogy, we want to protect you. We want to protect your information. If you have applications on here that you're using, you don't want anyone to just pick up the phone and all of a sudden be in your banking application or be in your contacts or, you know, respond back to an email, you know, and, you know, play a little joke on you. I mean, we used to have a lot of examples of this. So when you explain that to people about how you're protecting their data, it resonates. And it's not a battle of control anymore. You become partners with them of how important it is, not only for corporate data, but for their own personal data. So we do a lot of outreach in terms of security awareness around mobility.
So what are your, I hesitate to say favorite, but what policies do you think really, besides PIN, you know, gives you encryption in that, what do people need to have in place?
I mean, securing the device, we do policies around certain applications aren't allowed to be installed. It's a short list. It's a short list of known bad.
So you blacklist?
We do some blacklisting, very rarely. We push down policies around VPN and how we're getting mail. We have policies around if you jailbreak your phone, you don't get mail anymore. If you jailbreak your phone, you don't get VPN. And a lot of companies do that because of the risk that a jailbroken device introduces to the environment.
Especially if you saw recently, you know, with Apple and you're carrying an iPhone 6 Plus, that the recent jailbreak was installing keylogger information.
And
in China, 225,000 people lost their or had their accounts hacked because they jailbroke their phone.
Yeah. One of the things that is a little bit more of a challenge, but it's one of the policies that we've kind of stood firm behind, and this goes back not only for security, but our mobility center of excellence and our corporate systems like Exchange email. How do we manage the upgrade path? And at first we were kind of like, well,
you can't with
devices,
Apple. It's a
But you can educate your end users on when it's acceptable to upgrade and give some warnings. There was a couple. I remember it was a year ago that had that Exchange bug.
Yep.
Where there was
iOS 8.
Yeah, there was
8.0 or 8.01 or something.
Yeah, and it had a big impact on our Exchange servers, and it caused some performance hits. And so we wanted to make sure that we had at least a little buffer of time in order to test these upgrades and to make sure that there were no adverse effects on corporate systems, because kind of the worst case scenario is introducing something that takes down a communications channel.
I mean, I know you guys use an EMM. It's up to you who I mention, who you use. We don't care, or I don't think my listeners care. But it's one of those things. We always looked at it that we could say, if you upgrade before we allow you to, you're going to lose access to your data.
Yep.
And that's one of the things that we toyed with. And what we found is it actually worked better to be transparent with them and say, look, we want you to wait 2 weeks. And if we need you to wait longer than that, we'll tell you why. But 2 weeks gives us enough time to test to make sure the applications are working, nothing breaks, everything else. And we always found that the users were much more appreciative.
Yeah, so we give a heads up when we know that there's a new release coming out. We'll send out an email. We have a mobile app that delivers content to our devices that's pushed out. So, you know, you can go there and you can look at what our policies are. So it's, you know, easily accessible. It's not, well, you told me 5 years ago what the policy is, but I forgot what it is. It's at your fingertips. And there's also some tips and tricks, suggested applications, but also notifications on when it's okay to upgrade and when we're asking for, you know, just give us a little bit of time. Again, you have people that feel that they're involved in the process, we're finding that we have very little policy violation on that versus, you know, what we kind of thought in our head would happen.
So how do you enforce when you do? Because I'm sure there are times that you do have policy violation, and it's never fun.
Yeah.
Having been on the side where you have to enforce it, and, you know, either somebody gets angry that they lost access, or sometimes it's worse than that. And
yeah, it's luckily our Mobility Center of Excellence handles that. And like I said, we're very transparent about the policy. It's not a secret. It's not a surprise if someone decides that they're going to upgrade. And sometimes mistakes happen, though. Sometimes, you know, people will just push a button and they're, oh, man. So there are ways that we can help remediate it and roll them back to where they need to be. But it's happened very few times. We don't have to do that a lot.
Are you guys equal opportunity Android, iOS? Or are you iOS only, or not even allowed to say that?
Right now, we're primarily iOS. There's probably a few exceptions around there, but we found that you know, standardizing on a platform is just easier to manage, and it's what people are asking for. We don't give a lot of people that are coming in asking for, you know, some weird flip phone from somewhere still. You know, people seem to be very satisfied with the models that we're offering them and what they can do with them.
And when you're corporate owned, personally enabled, it's actually easier to pick a platform, and homogeneity makes it easier to handle.
Yeah, most of the time people are, you know, they don't care about the, you know, what the platform is really. They want their apps. So if you can deliver a platform that has their apps, they're pretty happy. Maybe somebody wants a little bit more screen real estate than the other person, or maybe they're heavy into music and they want more storage. So by allowing that for that flexibility, they like that. More, and they don't have to worry about a lot of stuff. They know that we're taking care of it in the background.
Awesome. So you've been at this a while. What are the best practices you've learned that you can share?
You know, I think one of the first things is to really look at what your core security values need to be and what those policies need to be, because there are certain things that are non-negotiable. And I've had to have those discussions before. And like one of them is, you know, the security to get into the device, because if we're opening a lot of stuff on the back end, whether it's, you know, touch or a PIN, there has to be something. And it's very hard to argue against that. There has to be some way to authenticate that I am the person that's can get into that device. And then you look at. How are people going to use them, and to make sure that you're not making decisions that are counterintuitive to that, because otherwise you end up you lose that battle. So one of the things is pick your battles wisely. But when you look at your security on those devices, I would say you need to manage them. These devices are so ubiquitous across, you know, an enterprise now. You need to make sure you understand what is going on those devices, what systems they're touching that are inside your corporate wall, and then how do you deprovision those devices? So a lot of times in the security, in our world in security, it's really, you know, it's less of a harmful activity to provision devices. You need to understand how you can deprovision them when necessary.
Now, so make sure. Someone leaves, it's lost, anything else,
yes.
What do you do?
Yeah, so those are kind of the really simple, straightforward ones to understand, and then listen to the feedback that you're getting from your internal customers. Listen to how they're using them, what their challenges are, and see if you can make it work. I mean, one of the biggest challenges when we initially got these was, I go back to, they're not Windows devices on what may be a traditional Windows network, which had traditional security measures wrapped around it. And to understand, you may have to think outside the box. You may have to architect your environment a little bit differently to accommodate these. Doesn't mean it's bad, but you have to be able to do that. And I was talking to our the manager of the Mobility Center of Excellence and about, you know, coming up here and being on the show. And she says, well, one of the things is you guys made it easy for us. You know, the network and the security and the desktop, the original ones, because we made those decisions earlier on that we weren't going to try to make these like the laptop. That we were going to have some flexibility, that we were, you know, maybe we would lose some of the control, but we would gain the ease of access and the ease of use. And to make those compromises really drove adoption. And you can still have the security around them. You know, it's just a matter of how deep you need to go and what are you really securing against.
Yeah, you know, it's great because, and I know you and I have talked about it online, I call that the fun principle, focus on the user needs.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And if you don't understand what the user needs and you lock them down to the point where they can't do their job, they find a way around it. And that's a much worse situation to be in.
Yeah. I mean, as a security person, I would love to have even more security because I'm a paranoid person. You know, so if it required a 10-digit PIN plus my firstborn's fingerprint, you know, I would be okay. But I'm not an
average. She would be because you'd have to cut her thumb off, but that's a whole other thing.
I'm not an average user, though. So you really need to listen to your average user and see, are you introducing some complexity into the environment that they don't need? When you're looking at these, you know, the screen real estate on these devices, and you want somebody to type in their network password 15 times to get to a web page, you've lost the battle already. You really have to look at you know, being a little bit creative on securing the device, but allowing the access that users need.
So those are best practices. Any lessons learned? Things that, you know, you might want to avoid doing this?
You know what? You're going to make mistakes.
Absolutely.
And I would say don't be afraid to make mistakes, recover quickly.
Them.
Yeah, recover quickly. Because, again, we originally out of you know, the gate thought, well, we'll put everything on the corporate network. We'll architect it this way, and that's the way it's going to be. And, you know, it's written in stone, and we're not going to make any changes. And about 2 weeks later, it's like, okay, well, we need to look at this again because our early POCs were coming back and, you know, this doesn't work the way I want it to work. So the lessons are you really have to listen, you know, engage in your customer base, get that feedback, learn how people are using them, and really, you know, you have to rethink your philosophy on what am I trying to protect. You can't treat these the way that you've treated traditional network devices. If you do, you're going to wrap yourself around an axle.
Awesome. So, you know, I like to I kind of warn you about this beforehand so you could think about it, but, you know, having you and I had Amy on the show, on the last show right before this, what advice do you have for women? You know, going into, you're in IT, you're in security, and sadly, it's not a field that there are a huge amount of women in. And, you know, I have daughters. I know, mm-hmm. as do you. So what advice do you have? You know, you followed an interesting career path.
Yeah. And, you know, the advice that I would give somebody today is different than I would give or follow 10 years ago. It's changed. The culture of just keep your head down and be quiet about some of the things that, you know, are frustrating. 20 years ago, you just did that. Unless there was something really egregious and, you know, you had to, you know, bring it to someone's attention.
And to be fair, I don't imagine you were ever shy.
No, actually, I was, and I didn't speak up a lot when I was younger just simply because, you know, I was really happy to have a job in tech. And a lot of times I was working in smaller environments. And, you know, once you did prove your technical chops, you know, it was typically smooth sailing after that. But you had to go through that kind of that rigor at the beginning of proving you belonged at the table. And that was frustrating and
sad.
And yeah. Yeah. 5 years ago, I would probably give different advice. But one of the things I think that, you know, regardless of whether you're, you know, female, or 5 years or 10 years is, you know, decide where your boundaries are. Decide what you're willing to go to battle for. Not everything is, you know, nuke from space. But also think about what you want to do with your career. If you're younger, time is a partner. Time is to your advantage. When you're my age, you know.
Please, you're not that old. Although you keep alluding to it, you really aren't.
Yeah. But you know, I would, you know, when I talk to my daughter, I say, you know, technology is an incredibly fascinating career to get into. And it's not just one thing like it was when I was starting out. You were either in network systems or you were in databases. And that was pretty much all there was. Now there's so many different domains within technology that you can get into and really have fun and find a passion. You know, find what you really care about. And then don't be afraid to step out of those comfort zones when you have an opportunity and learn. I built my kids, we built our first computer together, I think when my oldest son was 5. I took spare parts home from, the closet at work, and we sat there and we built a computer, and, they installed OS on it, and it worked, and they played games, and they were really happy, and they knew they could build a computer. Then it was, build a network, and then you really want to have a great foundation. So don't be afraid to learn about other parts of technology that maybe you don't think you're good at. Try coding. Build a lab in your house. Build a little a mobile app. And do something. And then you'll kind of find where you're comfortable with. And then There's going to be times when it becomes difficult. It's difficult to be a woman in technology. I probably have 100 examples I can give where it's just like you just shake your head and move on, or you can take it as an opportunity to maybe educate somebody. Because a lot of times I've found that when I do get annoyed at something or when something is just kind of like, wow, did that just come out of your mouth? They don't know. The other person doesn't know. That maybe that's not appropriate. So you can either, as a teachable moment, or you can alienate them. And I have a lot of friends that are in the industry that one of the things that gets me the most is when you're talking about security and says, "Does your security manager know that he?" So the pronouns become important. That's me. That's the chip on my shoulder. So I always I always point it out. Yeah, I'm not, aggressive about pointing it out, but I always say that. And people now kind of get that about me. So you can decide ahead of time, where you want to and how you want to react to something. And not everyone is the same. I don't come with the same baggage that, some of my other female colleagues in IT at Gallo do. We all have a different story. We all took a different path. We all react differently. And so I think expecting everyone to respond the same way or try to, progress in the same way is not fair to the individual.
So what I love is 98% of your advice applies to everybody.
Yeah.
And that's the cool part of it. I'm lucky enough that I've worked both for women and I've hired women. And, it's just I grew up that way, so it wasn't a big deal for me.
Yeah, when I was talking to one of the people on the data security staff about some of the questions that you had floated out there. And, yeah, he's been working on the team for about 7 years. He came out of community college. And his experience is – reporting to a woman who reports to a woman who now reports to a woman. He's like, I think there's too many sometimes. But that's different than other people's approach. You have to find a company that's supportive of diversity. And that's one of the great things about Gallo is, I look around in our IT department and, I've got my colleague that's also here at VMworld, and she runs the server and virtualization environment at an enterprise company. Our HP systems manager is a woman. Our mobility center of excellence is a woman. I report to director of security is a female. So you need to find a company that embraces that approach and that gives opportunities to women, to people of color, to people that aren't normally represented in, because it's very easy to go look across the street. And I did that this morning. I kind of said, it's like 20,000 men and a couple hundred women. And you start to think that's how everybody is, but you can find areas where it's changing. And I think that's, encouraging to see that. And I think the fact that we're just talking about it more and that people are not afraid to bring up these topics is a step forward.
Awesome. And I gotta say, I'm thrilled that you were able to make the time to be on the show today, because just gems. I mean, really.
Thank you.
It's Yeah, one of the missions of the MobileCast is we do startups, but it's also talking to people who've actually walked the walk, you know, and they know they've experienced it, and there are people listening to the show who want to know how to do it, and, you know, technically and otherwise. Yeah. And so I will agree with Amy that you are definitely an unabashed badass. we will certainly tag that with it. But, you know, look, thank you so much for appearing on the show today, because this was just awesome.
Well, thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
And listeners, thank you very much. That was episode 213 coming from VMworld. We will have one more episode, it looks like. We're recording tomorrow. And take care. We'll talk to you soon.